We'd like to just chat a bit with you about your perspective of the state of journalism, particularly with all of this technology. And you're one of those individuals that has been an icon in your profession, but also a noted author. So
I have to say that being in journalism as long as I have, and I started in it in 1982, I've seen quite a change in the field. I don't know that I would recommend for someone to go into it these days. That's probably the headline of my attitude change. It was when I got into it, there was some nobility involved in it. You did it not to get famous, but as a source of pride, of some sort of devotion to storytelling, telling the truth about things, learning things, informing your audience, and discovering the joy of writing, all sort of wrapped into one. Today, it seems to be more about making a name for yourself, getting a paycheck. People are hardly interested in print journalism and only, it seems, to be interested in television journalism. And I've always been suspicious of that because it's like I want my face out there more than I want my words out there. And the nature of the pressure of the business has changed quite a bit, too. So I can't say that I'm thrilled with the state of journalism as it is today. I would love to see it salvaged because I think it's a very, very, very important and integral part of the American fabric, and it's protected by our Constitution for a reason. But I do worry for its future.
If you were providing advice to my journalism students or to people who are listening about how they could, even with this new technology and this new focus on tweets and blogs and whatever else will come next, if they wanted to be like you, the next Mitch Albom, how would they go about that?
Well, I tell them to shoot higher, first of all. I think I would tell them to ignore tweets and blogs. That's not journalism. Tweeting is not journalism. In fact, it's the polar opposite of journalism because it's there's no thought involved. It's just instant reaction to something that's happening without any analysis. So if you see something falling from the sky and you tweet, you know, oh, my God, a plane is falling out of the sky. Only it turns out that it's not a plane. It was a piece of debris and you didn't have a very good angle on it. Not only have you told a lie, not only have you reported something that's not true, which is the polar opposite of journalism, but you've also probably created a scare, which is a very dangerous thing to do. And that's what Twitter and all the rest of that instant analysis, instant the pictures, instant everything does. Everybody makes too fast a judgment. So the first thing I would suggest is lose the whole idea of blogging and tweeting as having anything to do with journalism. Begin with journalism as a concept of reporting, of research, of checking and then double checking your facts, and crafting a story, be it for print, radio, or television, that not only will read okay the next day, but 20 years from now should still be the truth and should still present itself as an accurate representation of what took place. Now, that's not as exciting as Twitter or as exciting as YouTube or throwing up a funny video of someone, or a sexy video of someone or an embarrassing video of someone, but that's journalism. And so right from the front, you're going to have to take a stand as to whether you want to be cutting edge in terms of how many hits you get, or you want to be a true journalist.
Mitch, this is Mark Hollis. I think, you know, as we were going through the Cleveland Cavaliers situation with Coach Izzo, it was interesting to watch, and it really put some things into perspective with the media, because as you talk about what it takes to be an outstanding journalist, many of today's media are spending more time following the rumors, following the tweets, following the Facebook, because if they miss that one out of 300 that might be a factual statement, a fact that occurred, their bosses are going to come down on them extremely hard. So they probably, and I know this for a fact, many of them spend more time checking their tweets, checking their Facebook versus going in and really finding the facts. And it was interesting to watch during that process because Coach Izzo and I sat side by side and sort of watched it happen right in front of us.
Well, I'm sad to hear that. And I think there's several culprits in that. First of all, the bosses that you mentioned. The bosses in journalism need to step back and reflect the principles that they want their journalists to have. If all that matters to them is to be first with something, first, they better hang up their journalism hats and say that we're obviously not in the business of being right. We're just in the business of being first. Because if you're always going to press for timing, you're going to get it wrong. And you're going to get it wrong more often than you know. You know that famous scene in All the President's Men, you know, when they made a movie out of that, which was a great piece of journalism, you know, one of the exemplary exercises in long-form research that ultimately resulted in the resignation of a president, but took forever. It took forever. And there's that scene where Jason Robards plays the editor of The Washington Post, and the two reporters are pleading, Woodward and Bernstein, you know, well, we got this guy and this guy and this guy. And he says, but what about that? Do you have a second source? You know, well, no, we have one source, but he's a really good source. You don't got it. And he keeps saying to them, you don't got it. And he won't run it. Now, they had more than, you know, 100 people had on the Tom Izzo situation. But he wouldn't do it until it could be verified and re-verified and re-verified. Now, that kind of exercise doesn't go on with a lot of bosses today. They're more interested in the fact that let's make sure we got run with it. Stick it out there. Throw it out there. And you know how they couch this, Mark? I hate to say it. They say things like some sources indicate that, or there were reports that Tom Izzo was going to Cleveland, or there's been much chatter on the Internet about Tom Izzo going to Cleveland, none of which are facts. But they put the words in the sentence, Tom Izzo is going to Cleveland, in the same sentence as chatter, whatever. People ignore the words chatter or rumors, and they just focus on the words Tom Izzo is going to Cleveland. And they say, oh, see, it was reported Tom Izzo is going to Cleveland. That's this gray, nebulous area that reporting has become, where all you have to do is report on a rumor, and you're perpetuating the rumor.
And if you read it, it's true. That's the mentality of so many
darn
people.
Hard to take back. You know, apologies never get reported as widely or as loudly as the initial report. Retractions are never as well paid to, because there's still this assumption. And this is the crazy thing about America. There is still this assumption amongst the American public that if it was printed, it must be true. If somebody said it on radio or television, it must be true. And as long as the American public still sort of tilts that way on the veracity scale, rumors are going to be perceived more as fact. Eventually, we will get to a point in society where nobody trusts anybody who brings them the news, and everyone is presumed to be a liar, and then you might have the skepticism that it deserves. I would hate to see it come to that. I would rather see it tilt back the other way, that we get more responsible reporting, and you should be able to expect that if it's printed, it's true. But right now, that's working at odds with the actual truth.
I think when you do look at the power of words, you know, a small story to share during the Michigan football game with Michigan State this year. My son came to me on the drive down, ironically, and was commenting on the power of words that were in your book that he was assigned in a class. And it just so happened I ran into you in the press box and told you the story, and you were gracious enough to come down and spend time with my son TR and talk to him about it, and not only reading the book, reading the words, but then having the opportunity to engage with you after that. I think that's a responsibility, a privilege that we have in these professions or these business, that we do affect people positively or negatively with the words we write. That was a great story and a great situation to watch you engage my son in something like that. But that's what we're talking about. When we write something, it impacts people. His statement is, that book has changed my life forever. And that's a pretty powerful message.
Well, it was kind of him to say that, and I enjoyed meeting him. I think you tap into something that's important, perhaps in a tangential way, and that is that as a reporter and as a writer, you need to be willing to be out there in the very world that you're reporting on. Too much of what's going on in journalism today is being done by people in their basements. They never encounter the people who they write about. They never actually speak to them. They don't have to look them in the eye. I came up in the world, you know, where if you wrote something about somebody on the baseball team, whatever, you had to go to the game the next day. You were expected, in fact, to be at that game the next day. And if you wrote something critical of a player, you had to walk into that locker room and that player would look you in the eye. And you had to stand your ground. If what you said was true, and you were going to stand by it. And I've had many moments like this. I would walk in and I knew the player was angry at me. And I would say, listen, you know, I did not write that to hurt you. Tell me what part of it isn't true and I'll take it back. And I'm happy to say that in my career, I've never had a moment where someone said to me, you know, that was a lie, because they couldn't. Maybe they said, well, I didn't mean it that way. Or I said, well, that's different. The next time, don't say it. You know, but people don't do that in journalism today. They love to write rumors. They love to write criticism. They love to write about people being fired. You know, I have never in my life, and I hope to never, written a column that calls for a man to be fired. I've always felt that it's not my place to take away a person's livelihood, that man has a wife and children, family to support, issues that I might not even know about. Maybe he's got a sick sister that he's paying the bills for. Maybe he's got issues with his children. And here I am, some smug journalist who just says, yeah, fire the guy. A guy should be fired. Let's just take away his livelihood. Why? That's not my job. That's not my role. Now, there are some people out there who feel that I'm being too soft by doing that. And it's a shame that we've gotten to the point where somehow people feel it's your obligation as a journalist to decide other people's employment. But that speaks to, you know, I have a set of principles that's archaic by today's standards. And unfortunately, I don't know that they're being taught to a lot of these young journalists, if you call them that, who never have to go out and look that person in the eye. They call for that person to be fired, but they'll never meet them. They'll never have to, meet their gaze. They'll never have to answer a single one of their questions. So I understand the frustration of people like Tom Izzo and others who feel like they're swatting at ghosts. You know, who are all these people saying all these things? Why can't I just ask them face to face, why did you say that? Because they don't come out from, you know, behind their computers.
I think one of the things we can draw from your comments is the person who is on the radio, the person who writes the columns, and the person who wrote Tuesdays with Maury are all the same person with the same values. It's just a different way of telling the story.
Well, I hope that that's true. I really hope that that's true. Otherwise, I'm doing something wrong. I think that you should try, if you're going to go into storytelling and journalism and things like that, you have to sort of make a pact with yourself that you're going to be who you are. This is not the acting business. This is not Hollywood. I'm not entitled to, you know, five or six girlfriends on the side and a drug habit and everyone's going to love me no matter what, even if I say one thing and do another. You know, I don't know why those professions get away with it, but, you know, that's a story for a different day. But I think if you're going to write and you're going to give people a glimpse into your private life, and I have written about my life. Tuesdays with Maury was a true story. Have a Little Faith was a true story. Much of what I write in the newspaper reflects things that have actually happened to me personally. Then I think you have an obligation to sort of be that same person. I don't think that's asking too much of someone. That ought to be the way all of us behave.
And I think that's probably the underlying lesson for those future journalists, is that that's what we have to strive for, not to see our technology self and our work self and our self at home to be different people, but they all have to be true to the same set of values.
Yeah, I think a good test is to say, write something or report something, take a look at it and ask yourself, when I come back to this 10 years from now, when I'm leafing through my files or running through my computers or leafing through papers, will I be proud of it? Will I still be proud of it? Will I be proud of the work that it took to put it out, the reporting that went into it, the writing, the use of words, the use of pictures? Will I still be proud of it? And if 10 years from now you go back and you look at it and you are, then you did something right at the time. And if every year you're ashamed of what you did the year before, then you're moving too fast and you're putting things out before they're baked. You're taking pies out of the oven before they rise, and you need to spend a little bit more time on the craft.
To shift gears in closing, you have a very public platform, but you've used it for public good in the work in your charities, the work in Haiti and the homeless in Detroit. You want to talk a bit about that and how that's so important to you and who you are?
Well, the credit for that really goes to my old professor, Maury Schwartz. I wasn't always this way, to be bluntly honest. I was pretty self-oriented. I remember visiting him when he was dying back in 1995, and One time he said to me, what do you do for your community? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, you know, charities, efforts, volunteers, what do you do for your community? And I said, well, I write checks. And he said, anybody can write a check. You've been given a voice, and you have an obligation to use that voice for the good. It's not enough for you to just sign your name at the bottom of a check. Go out and do something with this voice that you've been given. And Maury was very good at making people feel guilty. He was a specialist in the guilt department. And I think that really was a turning moment for me, and I realized he was right. And I started my first charity that year. And he also said something to me that I never forgot. That's the tail end of this, which is people used to go into his room all the time to talk to him, to try to cheer him up, you know, because he was dying. And they would go in with these funny stories or photographs, and they would come out an hour later and they'd be crying, but they were crying about like their divorce or their job or their problems. And they said, I don't know. I went in to try to cheer him up, but after a few minutes, he started talking to me and I started telling my problems, and then he cheered me up. And I went in and I said, I don't get it. You're the one who's dying. You know, why don't you take some sympathy? And he said, because taking makes me feel like I'm dying, and giving makes me feel like I'm living. And I never forgot that sentence. It's very profound. Giving makes me feel like I'm living. It even rhymes, you know. And I have found the more charitable stuff that I've done, the more alive I feel. The more I get involved with homeless people in Detroit, or help out or put a roof on a church or go down to Haiti or feed kids who otherwise don't eat, the more awake I feel, the better I feel about myself, and the less I worry about my own problems. It's a great antidote to your own sort of self-absorbed problems. It's just go out and find people who have worse ones than you, and there are plenty of them. So I've been motivated to follow those two little pieces of advice from Maury, and he's been right all along.
Are there any closing words of wisdom beyond that one?
All I would say to young people, if they're listening to this, is first of all, you'll never listen to an old person, because I didn't when I was young, and you're not going to either. But hear it, even if you're not listening, because sometimes you hear and then maybe somewhere down the pike, it starts to become true for you. American society as it is now places more than enough emphasis on self, and on celebrating yourself, and on taking care of yourself, and you're the greatest thing on earth, and bang your chest, and sing your own song, and win American Idol, and be the star of your own reality series, and get the big contract in sports, and have your own rap song. Everything is about you, 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 you. But I've seen the end of life. I've spent a lot of time with people who are dying or have died, and I can tell you that the loneliest people at the end of life are the ones who spend all their time celebrating themselves. And the people who feel like they are the most content and die the most blissfully and peacefully are the ones who are surrounded by other people. So it's going to be what you do for other people in the end that's going to make for a happy life. It's not going to be how many of your own rap records you could sing or how many of your own reality shows you could star in. It's a very empty existence, and our culture is emphasizing, unfortunately, the empty part of it and not the part that really enriches you. So life is with other people and is with giving to other people. And if people remember nothing more of these last 20 minutes than that one sentence, remember that, and hopefully sometime down the pike it'll come in handy and make a difference in your life.